BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Well, every week you hear us probably mostly on BCFM. Well, this week the show has come to you from the BCFM studios in Russelltown Avenue, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston all over the world, including South America. We have two studio guests this week, Kenneth McFarlane from Bridgewater. He's going to tell listeners how to make cheese and yoghurt in your own home. And we also have Guthrie Kennard here with his guitar, all the way from Austin in Texas. He's written a song especially for the people of Bristol, which you'll hear and play later on in the show. We have two features from Anthea Page, an interview with some demonstrators at the Against Police Violence rally here in Bristol last week, and an interview with astrologer Judy Malone. Malcolm Greaves reads the second instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, and that's set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. Jess Barks is away up north, but Trevor Carter is here instead to read us a couple of his poems. Bristol songwriter, singer and acoustic guitarist Katie Brooks plays for us later on. My name is John Peters Coleman. Well, I'm delighted straight away to introduce all the way from Austin in Texas, the legendary blues guitarist and singer Guthrie Kennard. Guthrie was playing at one of Bristol's top music hotspots on Sunday nights, the Coronation Tap in Clifton Village. Hello.
Hello, JPC. How are you doing today?
I'm all right. What did you think of the Coronation Tap?
Great. I mean, Mick and Jan are just wonderful, wonderful. What a great venue. And there are so many great, great artists that came out. I was honored. It was more of a jam session, you know, and just had a blast.
So what other musicians were you playing with?
Sir John Finlan, you know, was, I guess, kind of the musical director. And we had Eddie Denny on guitar. We had Richie on bass. Peaches on the drums. Gary on trumpet. And, let me think. And we had the Cat Daddy himself out there, Mr. Andy Shepherd, yeah. Saxophone. And let's see. And I'm trying to think who else. Oh, and Dave and John Pierce on classical and jazz violin or fiddle, as they say in Texas.
Okay.
You know, just a tremendous, tremendous artist. And Little Beth Riley was out there and she didn't sing, but she was out there to support, you know, the fun.
Cool.
You know, and she's a great artist as well.
Are you sort of a true hardcore blues traditionist, or do you extend into a little bit of kind of jazz or classical or anything else?
Well, I've been playing blues since I was a kid, you know. It's one of those deals, you know, a lot of the 60s British rock and roll bands, you know, were, you know, kind of threw it back in our face. Actually, it made the blues kind of cool because they had to put the hair on the blues, you know.
Yeah.
So as kids, you know, we grew our hair long and got out there. And it's like John Mayall on the Blues Breakers. I mean, you'd listen to those records and they were just great. And you could look at them and go, well, who wrote this? And then you'd discover that they're Freddie King songs or whoever. And then you just go back and kind of do, even though the blues was at a front door,
yeah,
you know, sometimes we miss that, you know, sometimes we just didn't know a good thing when you heard it, you know, and so we just rediscovered it, and I was, I love Johnny Winter, and I think I found my niche, you know, listening to rock and roll blues, you know.
You've released a new album lately. Do you think that the audience for the blues is kind of still young, or do you think it's kind of aged with you? How do you think people take the blues?
Well, the blues is, you know, it's one of those deals where I played with such great blues artists. I played with Smokin' Joe Kubek, and he's a world-renowned blues artist. And I found that, you know, there is an older audience to, I can't talk today, older audience to the blues.
Yeah.
And it's very guitar-oriented out of Texas. Mm. So you're going to find a lot of young guitarists coming out and watching these guys play and stuff. So it's a mix. The blues has kind of dipped down a little bit, but it'll resurge again.
Yeah, I mean, it was a resurgence back in the 60s, I guess, which was, for a lot of people, especially of your generation, would have been sort of the great sort of heyday, especially when you were young, I guess.
Oh, it was. I mean, you know, if you've seen that new movie, it's out with Beyonce, with Cadillac Records. Check that out. It's kind of the history of Chess Records.
Okay.
When they signed Muddy Waters, you know, and all those, you know, those cats. And it's an amazing movie because you can see the history of where, you know, it came from just Delta Blues into Electric Blues and such and such. And it's a great movie to watch. If you get a chance, check it out.
How did you approach doing your latest album? Did you kind of do some old standards? Do you write your own songs as well as playing?
I write my own stuff.
You write your own stuff?
Yeah, it's one of those deals where I'm not a purist when it comes to the blues because I love rock and roll. I mean, I don't know if there's any rock and roll left today, but it's, it, I mean, all changes. Each generation has its own music. But with me, I've always been writing since I was a kid, but I play bass.
Yeah.
So, and that's how I ended up in England, playing with a great artist from Bristol, Mr. Eddie Martin.
Okay.
Great blues artist, great guy.
He plays at the Old Duke in town.
He does. He does. He hosts get my mouth to work. Open mic there.
Yeah.
On Tuesday nights, I believe, and also he plays on Sunday nights when he's in town.
Okay.
Eddie's great. Eddie's, you know, he's the real deal. So if you get a chance, go see him, everybody.
Yeah. If it's rude to ask, I mean, John Mayall recently had his 70th birthday celebration. How many years in the blues have you been going?
Probably. Well, I'm 50. I'll be 58 in July. So since I was about, I get so old I can't count no more. since I was about 13, 14, I started playing.
Okay. Did you kind of start writing almost straight away? Kind of pretty much?
Probably in about 1969 I started writing. Cause I remember thinking about the other day, I remember writing my first song, you know, and my grandmother passed away, so I wrote it about that. And a good friend of mine, he was, you know, in the Army and went AWOL for a while, came back, and he had a tape recorder. Tape recorders, you know, like reel-to-reels back then. I mean, very few people had them. I mean, it wasn't like today by any means. So we took advantage of it, and I found those tapes about a year or two ago, and, of course, they're quite primitive. But it's really cool to hear something from way back when that's, you know, with Fuji and myself. And then, of course, the Army came and got him, and you know, he went off to Vietnam or something, and anyhow, it's there's a lot of history there. The world has changed quite a bit since then.
I wanted to ask you earlier, before I forget, when you were at the Coronation Tap in Clifton, Bristolians who have been for a drink there, this will be important to them, did you try any of the exhibition cider?
I think I had a sip.
Yeah? What did you think?
Oh, it was great.
You don't have to say that. Don't think Bristolians will not come and pillage you if you say you didn't like it. But
I don't really drink, and but I think I had enough the other night to hair lip the queen. So that tells me it was pretty good.
It is good. One of your latest songs.
Can I say that?
Yeah.
Okay.
But probably, I don't know. If you can't, I mean, Phil will just sort of smack the bottom later on. He's the manager of the station. One of your latest songs, talking about a new album, I believe, is about the people of Bristol themselves. You've written a song for us.
It is. I mean, I love this song. It's on the new record, and it's one of those deals. John Finlan is my brother, and over here, and I was hanging out with him one night. He was playing. Yeah, he has a great blues band as well.
Yeah,
John Finlan blues band, and. So John was feeling no pain that night. I think he, you know, had a lot of cider in him, or Guinness, or one of the two. I can't remember. So
hope you're not both at the same time.
Yeah, knowing John, he probably forgot which one he was drinking first.
Ooh.
But can I say that?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding, John. Anyhow, so we came out of the bar, and it's down there right over around the Old Duke. And because of Eddie Martin, I've met so many, many, many great people here. In the live music scene is just great. The artists are great. The people are just wonderful. And actually, the food is good.
If I can push you, we're slowly running out of time.
Okay.
So,
this is Bristol. So I wrote this for everybody here in Bristol.
Thank you.
dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Welcome now to Kenneth McFarlane. Kenneth has come here from Bridgewater in Somerset to tell listeners how to make yoghurt and cheese in your own home. Hello.
Hello. Good evening.
How long have you been interested in the making of cheese and yoghurt?
Oh, I hate to say it, about 30 years now.
Right.
Yes.
Other than for your own sort of domestic pleasure, what are the main benefits have you discovered of yoghurt and cheese making?
It's provided me with a living for the past 30 years, which is one of the main benefits. It's an area that's always fascinated me ever since I was at school.
Hmm.
How you get this liquid and you can transfer it into different products.
Right.
You know, basically liquid into solid that lasts a long time. There's so many different varieties, different flavours. It comes in all sorts of shapes and sizes. And surprisingly enough, it's relatively easy to make.
Okay. Yeah. So you're sort of convinced that most the layman, the cheese layman, can kind of construct this glorious item, this comestible, in their own home with sort of fairly basic equipment.
Yes. If you're capable of cooking or baking or anything like that, you can make cheese and yoghurt.
Brilliant. What is your favourite cheese, I suppose, is the obvious question that I feel like I should ask at the beginning of the interview.
My favourite cheese? It would have to be a vintage cheddar, to be honest with you.
Yeah, a local one.
A local one, yes. Out of all the cheeses in the world, a good cheddar is really difficult to beat.
Okay, where are you from originally?
Originally Scotland.
Originally Scotland, okay. Whereabouts?
Paisley.
Do they have a great tradition of cheese in Scotland? I can't really think of any Scottish browns off the top of my head.
Oh, yes.
Yeah?
Yeah, yes. As everywhere, they make cheddar, but more recently they've gone back into Dunlop, which is a fairly old Scottish cheese. Okay. Caledonian, again, which is another old Scottish cheese.
Okay.
And as I say, in England, there is more and more small cheeses and different cheese varieties cropping up.
So the number of varieties is growing. In fact, this is a growing industry.
It has. But 5 years ago, if you asked the question, we'd be 50, 60. There's now over 400 different varieties in the UK.
Cool, blimey. This will probably be too good to be true, but did you move sort of down south to be nearer to Cheddar, the spiritual home of cheese?
Yes. It's a sad answer to that question.
You are committed.
Well, yes. I mean, there's some main cheese-making areas in the UK. There's Scotland, where I started from.
Yeah.
First of all, I moved to Yorkshire, which is another large area. Yeah, then I moved into Cheshire.
Right.
Which is another one of the large areas, and the final one down the country is Somerset.
So how much sort of money do you manage to make from your cheese and yoghurt? What I suppose if people are, especially in these economic times, maybe looking for sort of home industries or cottage industries, I mean, can you make a living?
You can make a living out of purely making cheese. Yes, I mean the large factories make about 40,000 tons a year,
right.
But there are people that make cheese in their home. In a relatively small scale, milk is not that expensive. The ingredients are not that expensive. All you need is a sort of a pan thermometer, and off you can go. You can make cheese.
Okay. How old is cheese making? Tell us a little bit about sort of the history of cheese making.
The history of cheese making goes back about 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. They believe it. It started in Roman times. It was a fairly widespread practice throughout Europe,
right.
The Middle East, and it's mentioned in Greek mythology, and there's murals depicting cheese manufacturing in Egyptian tombs.
Right.
So it originally was thought that it started with people storing milk in the stomachs of animals, and the rennet would turn that into curds and whey.
Right, what is rennet?
Rennet is an enzyme found in the calf's stomach. It's in most juvenile animals because to digest milk, they have to turn it into a solid.
Right.
So the rennet is secreted from the stomach, turns the milk into solid, and it's digested. So when people use the stomachs as storage bags, this process happened and they turned up the curds and whey.
Okay, do they still use this process? What sort of processes do they use today?
It hasn't changed that much. That's why it's so easy to make.
Okay.
All it is slightly cleaner stainless steel vessels,
yeah.
And you still animal rennet is still used, although there's several different types of rennet as well now.
Okay. So we've got an unemployed man or woman, and they're wondering what the opportunities are now that you've kind of got our interest. What are they? What can people do?
The opportunities. The easiest cheeses to make to start off with are soft cheeses. The reason for that is you don't need much equipment, and unlike cheddar, you don't have to mature it for 6 months to a year before you can sell it. You're looking at having a product ready to eat in between 5 and 10 days.
Right. Blimey.
So it can be that quick.
Yeah.
If you want to. Making it is relatively simple. For soft cheese, there are two main processes. One is straightforward acidification of the product.
Mm.
If you lower the pH of milk, the solids will eventually coagulate and give you a curd. We sell a kit on our website which does that for 1 litre. You can make cheese overnight, strain it off the next morning, and you've got 200 to 250 grams of cheese. It's that easy.
Richard, just briefly kind of praise again the process of making cheese. I've got some milk, I've got my stainless steel vessel, I've got pots and pans.
You start off with your milk.
Yep.
You can use pasteurised or unpasteurised milk for making cheese.
Okay.
Pasteurisation is a fairly simple process. You heat it up. For milk, it's 63 for 30 minutes or 71 seconds 71 degrees for 15 seconds.
Okay.
And that's your pasteurised it. You can use it either way, for whatever you want. So you have your milk, you warm it up to about 30, 32 degrees C in your pan. To this you add a culture. Cultures are readily available. They're organisms that ferment lactose, produce lactic acid.
Right.
Hence you get the acidic flavour in cheese.
Okay, and these will be available on your website?
Oh yes, they're available on the website as well. Yes.
Brilliant.
And you add these, you can leave it for 20 to 30 minutes. Mixing in to let the culture start to grow and start to produce some acidity. Then after that, so there's two methods. You can carry on letting it, the acidity increase and produce a soft cheese that way, which gives you a short texture. It's more like Philadelphia.
Okay.
If you're looking to make that. If you want a more interesting soft cheese, then you can add rennet at this stage. The rennet does the same job as it does as the calf stomach. I should say for vegetarians that there is microbial rennet available, which is made from mould, not a calf stomach.
Okay.
So it's suitable for vegetarians. It does the same job. It splits the casein molecule, and this forms a gel. It sits fairly solidly, like a large blancmange. Some people use that as junket, which is a milk pudding.
Right.
You can eat it like that. It's actually so hard, set so firm, you can actually put your hand on top of it and shake it back and forward. When it gets to that stage, you get a knife and you cut it into cubes.
Okay.
Now, after this process, you ladle it out into a mould. The easiest moulds to use are a colander. If you line that with a cheesecloth, obviously you have to buy a cheesecloth, but cheesecloths are fairly cheap. You ladle the curds and whey out into the colander, let it strain through. You can then fold the cheesecloth over, tighten it a bit, leave it overnight, letting it drain. Come down the next morning and you have your cheese in the mould.
Okay, I've been listening agog, but time is ticking on. So lastly, briefly, I mean, how do you get your cheese out to people once you've made it?
Once you've made it, there's farmers' markets, which are a very effective way of doing it. Delicatessens are very interested in different forms of cheese. Restaurants are one of the big ones at the moment.
Okay.
Because they're always looking for something new, different to put in their dishes and claim as being a locally produced product.
Okay. What can you do to the cheese? Because there's so many different types and all the different flavours. Briefly, what do you do to the cheese to give it different flavourings?
Different flavourings come from the cultures. You can use straightforward cultures that produce acidity. Then you can use ones that produce the acetal, which is the sort of buttery flavouring cheese.
Yeah.
Leuconostoc produces a lot of gas, gives you a lot of openness in the cheese.
Okay.
Which again gives you a different flavour to it. Or you can add moulds.
Yeah.
And it gives you a blue cheese.
Okay. Brilliant. Tell us about your website briefly, because obviously that's the main sort of place that you're recommending people go.
Our website is set up for people who want to make small quantities of cheese and yoghurt.
Yeah.
Starting from 1 litre upwards.
Okay.
We have everything there that you want. You can contact us. We're quite happy to send you out recipes, give you advice, any help you need to get started going.
Brilliant. www.cheeseyoghurtessentials.com.
That's it.
Brilliant. Kenneth McFarlane, thank you very much for coming in. That was very interesting.
Oh, thanks very much.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Last week, the group against police violence organised a protest outside the police headquarters in the city centre. The rally was sparked off by the recent death of Ian Tomlinson at the G20 demonstration in London. Dialect's reporter Anthony Page was there to find out local views on police violence at demonstrations.
Sorry, you probably don't want to give your name, do you?
We'll say that my name's Alexis, but my name doesn't matter.
OK. Can you tell us why you're here today?
We're to demonstrate against ongoing state violence, police brutality. They've killed a man on the streets of London. It could happen to anyone. The guy was on his way home. He wasn't a demonstrator, but that distinction doesn't matter. It could happen to any one of us. This has been going on for a long, long time. It just takes a man getting killed by the police on the streets of London for people to notice it. The behaviour of the police on that demonstration is routine. Make no mistake about it. That is business as usual.
But the thing is, not all the police are bad.
Our experience is that whenever you start to move, whenever you get involved seriously in fighting for social change in a better world, the police are always there, and it is generally all of them who will hit you with batons and try and beat you off the streets.
Do you think this is coming from the government?
Yes, it's coming from the highest levels, absolutely. It's nothing new. Like, the police are there to protect the interests of the rich and capital. More and more people are being forced into poverty and realising the nature of this system. More people will be taken to the streets, and we'll see clearly the gloves of the state will come off and they'll bare their teeth. That's what we're beginning to see now.
So you're talking about civil unrest?
Yeah, and this country has a long, long history of civil unrest.
So how many people do you think are going to turn out today for this? How have people heard about it?
It's been put out in community centres, pubs, shops, fly-posted on the streets. The word's got out, and a lot of people are angry. You can't just confine this anymore to like a few hardcore anarchists. There's a lot of people here from kind of different walks of life. People are angry. People aren't going to take it anymore.
Do you think it'll make any difference?
It's important to be a visible presence on the streets and to not let police violence go unchallenged. So we're not going to change the police. We don't believe the police can be reformed. It's in their nature to be violent thugs. But it's important for people to take to the streets and make our voices heard and to show solidarity with each other.
Have you had any personal experience of police brutality?
Yeah, over many years.
Tell us, incident or not?
I prefer not to talk about specific incidents, but just beatings that are routine on every demonstration is what they do.
So it's mainly the demonstrations they get heavy with?
You chat with these guys here from communities all over Bristol, like South Mead, Lockleys, Hartcliffe. Those are the people that experience police violence in a routine, everyday fashion. It's just unseen, and it's whipped up by media stories about thugs and hoodies on our streets or immigrants or whatever, and that justifies like state's attacks on like marginalised people in society. So those people have direct experience of police violence, as demonstrators do. It's not just confined to demonstrations. No.
Have you got anything to say?
Yeah, I've had police violence. I've had stitches in the head with the cops. I've been like...
What were you doing to...
I was on demonstration, but I wasn't hurting anybody. I wasn't hurting any people, and I wasn't hurting the police. But they caught hold of me and hit me, and I ended up with like 4 or 5 stitches in the head. That was years ago.
Did you get any compensation?
I didn't get arrested, so I didn't actually go and make a claim that they'd hit me. You know what I mean? I was covered up, my face was masked up when we were on the demonstration. But
did it put you off going to demonstrations?
Yeah, but you work with other stuff in the community, encourage people to build bigger amounts of people doing different stuff. Certain places that like you people catch the police off guard, and that they do get upset, but they sometimes things push forward, you encourage, you build, because there's so many people that aren't actually involved, and they just watch. But they are on your side, but they're obviously scared by a lot of it. Like, I seen some graffiti up by the railway station by Temple Meads, and it said that it said who carries the weapons on the demonstrations. And the people who carry the weapons on the demonstrations are the cops. They always have been.
The police are just a representation of a state which is inherently violent. Whenever the state has its... It feels challenged, you see it more clearly, and I think we're seeing times like that at the moment. It's always these dangerous anarchists that are, or even terrorists, the people's attention gets diverted to like the latest scapegoat of the day and the latest sort of media devil, but in actual fact it's the police and the state and the armies of governments that are doing violence every single day. Look at how many people are being killed every single day by the weapons of capitalism, and also just, it's important to say, the poverty of capitalism, because that is violence as well. That's normal. So if capitalist peace means millions of people dying of hunger, preventable diseases, what sort of peace is that? Right, so one thing we noticed with the whole, it's worth saying a bit about this, the case of Ian Tomlinson. One thing that was really clear was that the news reporting afterwards completely followed the police press reports, press releases about it being a heart attack. They completely towed that line. And another thing we noticed was how the media works, and that was with a story about a terror raid in Manchester, a series of terror raids in Manchester. Okay? So on the one hand, you see a story about the police killed a guy on a demonstration in London. That story got quickly eclipsed by the police protecting our freedom and saving us from bad terrorists in Manchester. It's smoke and mirrors. It's the sort of tricks that the media uses to divert people's attention and to present the police as like protectors of our freedom. And no surprises for us. A couple of weeks later, all charges dropped. Nothing. Nothing came from that case. The guy's released without charge. So there wasn't any terrorists there. It's just part of the one big game that they play, really. To
are you talking about television media or newspapers?
Corporate media, yeah.
What, BBC or
all of the mainstream corporate media? People need to kind of wake up and see that there's so much more that goes on other than the corporate mainstream media.
That was Dialect's Anthea Page reporting from the anti-police demonstration here in Bristol last week. If you want to find out more, log on to their website, which is www.againstpoliceviolence.org.uk. Now it's time for a song now from Bristol songwriter, acoustic guitarist and singer Katie Brooks.
The song's called Lines.
Frozen lines, we walk just to prove ourselves to the other ones, and the other ones walk the same line just to prove themselves to us. And I feel like I'm trying to race myself to the finish line. I don't like the way this is messing with my mind. I don't know why we feel like we've always got something to prove. Seems to me that life is about more than just clocking up the things that we do. And I feel like I'm trying to beg my way into feeling good. My whole life is a waste if I'm not doing what everyone should. And oh divine, these hours of mine, but I can't seem to give them my time.
Katie Brooks on MySpace as ever, myspace.com/Katie, spelled K-A-T-E-Y, Brooks. And I think she's probably on Facebook as well. It's time now for the very first instalment of, no it's not, it's the second instalment, tell a lie, of Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves. A story set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. If you remember from last week, in 1922, out of the need to earn a living, our Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. the people in customs he came across not quite what he was expecting or used to. He wrote about his experiences in a diary. The intro music, a tune called Old Molly Oxford, was performed by musicians in the famous Royal Naval Volunteer pub in King Street, Bristol, who meet every Tuesday for an impromptu music session.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Tame people. G.N. Clark of Oriel told me that the then prophet's father, who'd been a parson here, said that Tame was remarkable for its miserable human nature. Even its vices and faults were miserable. But I found that their only characteristic, whether fault or virtue, is peacefulness. When we first came here, they often told me that the High Street, 190 feet across, is the second broadest in England. As it is usual for people to boast about rather than belittle their town, I was puzzled, till I discovered that the Tamensians avoid all occasion for strife. Hence, if they tell a foreigner, and you are a foreigner here for your first generation in the town, that the street is the second broadest, the man from Marlborough or Oxford or elsewhere grants it to you, and there is no strife. A charming person, G.A. Cohen, came to us and wanted to hunt with his nice family 3 or 4 days a week. I sent him to a jobmaster who quoted so much per horse per day, as would have amounted to £40 a week, whilst telling him that he couldn't hunt 3 days in any case. So there was no strife. And no Mr. Cohen, who took his leave and his money to Bicester. For Johnny McNaught, whilst staying here in full training, I found a sparring partner to take him on, a fine, enormous fellow with a local reputation. But twice McNaught waited for him, and in vain. Avoidance of strife again. Once I ran out across the road to stop a man maltreating his little horse, and the brute, not the horse, ran across to meet me.
"Now then, you foreigner, get back to your house, or I'll set about you."
As I didn't speak, he flicked at me 3 times and sent my spectacles broken into the road. There was a crowd already drawn by the man's noise with the horse, but when I looked around for witnesses, they were all rabbiting into their holes, avoiding litigation. Of the two I caught, one said that he hadn't been looking my way, and another that he'd only just come out. As I came inside, St. John Irvine, having watched the incident from upstairs, struggled past me and, partly out of kindness and partly to seek strife, caught up the man and gave him a perfect hell of oaths and names. He very kindly gave evidence for me at the petty sessions, but the case was adjourned because the defendant's witnesses were on holiday. They were always on holiday. At the next sitting, these witnesses, now returned from their holiday, gave the credit to me for all the fine language that St. John Irvine had used, with the result that the magistrates must have had before them a picture of a drunken brawl, and fined the man 10 shillings, and me nothing. In the report of the proceedings in our local paper, I was spoken of as Fothergill. The editor was rather shocked that I, a newcomer in Tame Town, had caused strife. Freemasons. Certain sections and coteries are not so easy going. When we first came here, we did the Freemasons' feeds, and they always complained. Moreover, taking advantage of our doing little business, they beat us down in price. In fact, we started badly with a feast in the first week of our taking over, when at the advice of our predecessor, a mason, we fed them at almost cost price. I ventured to ask him what was the good of that. Why, for advertisement, of course. But I soon found out it was only an advertisement for the same thing again. They were very hard masters, and Kate and I trembled at the end of each meal to get their complaints. Mr. X had to wait for his sweet. Mr. Y's fish was cold. After a couple of years of this, the secretary came to pay a bill, saying, Mr. Fothergill, I want your opinion. The tiler didn't have fish for his dinner last night. The tiler is a sort of doorkeeper, and in this lodge has the full meal kept hot for him to eat in the kitchen afterwards. The tiler didn't have fish. What do you think about making a reduction from the bill? I wondered whether I could afford yet to offend these people. My opinion is, Mr. W, that it's the pettiest complaint you have made to date, and as our temporary cook is the tiler's wife, the fellow ought to have got a good dinner here. Moreover, you ordered dinner for 36, and by over-catering I served 42, and so saved your face. Remember, Mr. Fothergill, there are many in the lodge who are deeply dissatisfied with their treatment here, and are agitating to go elsewhere. Even at that, I thought I couldn't yet afford to let them go, so I became pleasant, and finally the secretary said, "What if I sign the cheque in full, and you give the man a shilling?" I shouted with laughter, opened the door to him, and they never came again. And now a confectioner, who had recently become a mason, does for them. And there is no more occasion for strife.
Thank you very much to the actor Malcolm Greaves for his excellent reading as ever, and you can hear part three next week.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, now, another feature from Anthony Page. It's an interview with Judy Malone, who is an astrologer.
Studying for many years, and about 4 years ago I took a course in astrology with the Bristol School of Astrology, and I've got a diploma which I received after 4 years of studying with them.
So can you tell us about astrology, what it means?
Right, well, of course a lot of people, when they hear the word astrology, think of sun sign columns in newspapers and magazines. But in fact, it's very much more than that. When you do a birth chart for somebody, which is how you make somebody an individual as opposed to just lumped under one of the 12 sun signs, you actually draw up a map of the heavens at the place and the actual time, as well as the date that they were born. Because what was happening at the time of birth was that there was a constellation rising on the eastern horizon, which is actually the pivot of their whole chart. So as well as that, it's the sun sign that everybody knows. But that is not the whole story. If somebody with the sun sign Aries was born, for instance, at 3:30 in the morning, it's quite possible that the rising sign, or the sun coming up on the sign on the eastern horizon, was Capricorn, which gives them a completely different outlook than just being Aries. Also, it's the position of all the planets in the skies at the time, where the Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars and Jupiter, and then there's Saturn, Uranus, Neptune and Pluto to take into account as well. Those are the outer planets. And they all have geometric relationships with each other, in other words, angular relationships. And the relationships between each planet, as well to the, as the Sun, and the ascendant, has a huge effect on your personality, so, or your characteristics.
Are you saying that the actual moment of your birth is very important to your whole personality?
It's incredibly important, because the rising sign, which is this one I've been talking about on the eastern horizon, it's the way that people actually view you immediately, and the way you tend to come across immediately to people. So that my own sign is Cancer, and I've got Pisces very strongly in my makeup, so you would expect me to be sort of terribly obviously sensitive and a bit watery and weak and weedy. But my outer sign is Sagittarius, so I come across to people immediately as being quite outgoing and bright and bouncy, and that is how I do instantly see the world. But there's much more than that to me, and very different things, and the same applies to you and everybody else.
So could someone have a bit of a shock, say they thought, oh, I'm a typical Aries, and then they go and see an astrologer and they realise that they're a totally different person to the one they thought they were?
Well, they're not a totally different person. For instance, knowing that you're Aries, I wouldn't automatically say, therefore, you must be very independent, forthright, like to lead things. But I would say that in order to feel comfortable with yourself, that's what you need to do. So you need to sort of nurture those things within yourself. But I bet you that if your moon sign was in Cancer, you would recognise nurturing qualities in yourself. And that children, women, family were all quite important to you. Well, I mean, you might say, who isn't it important to? But it would have a particular importance to you. Doesn't mean to say that they're good things in your life. I mean, you can have someone with a moon in Cancer and you'd say, well, the mother figure is very important there. And in fact, you might have had a terrible relationship with your mother. Doesn't actually mean, but it would mean that your relationship with your mother was probably very important, or the one with your children.
So you're obviously a professional astrologer. What do you think about people reading their horoscopes in daily newspapers and believing it? Do you think that's quite a dangerous thing?
I don't think it's probably dangerous. Unfortunately, it sets you up for all the sceptics saying, oh, you know, how can you divide the population just into 12 different types and that's it? Well, of course, you can't. And I have always been rather sort of poo-pooing of sun sign columns in newspapers, and I've always said, oh, no, I wouldn't dream of writing one myself. Funnily enough, I read a very well-known and high-flying astrologer, read a paper, an article that he wrote, in which he said that he didn't mind sun sign astrology at all, because, first of all, the people that write them are generally proper astrologers, you know, I mean, they've trained and they know what they're doing, and so they do deal with it in as serious and sensible a way as you can. But he felt that at least having astrology out there, that it was a very good thing to keep people thinking about their lives, because if somebody who's a Taurian, whoever they are, reads, well, you're going to be approached with an idea from a friend and you ought to think twice about, you know, launching into it with them. You're not doing any harm, you're making somebody think about something. So if a friend does approach them with some sort of harebrained scheme, maybe a very good one, you can look at it and you give it more thought, because the thought has been implanted in your mind that that's a good thing to do.
It is a bit tailored, isn't it?
It's very tailored. It does lend itself to people saying that it's a load of rubbish. So generally, I don't like the commercially predictive astrology. But I do still take the point of this other astrologer who was suggesting that if it makes somebody give thought to their life, that's good. But generally speaking, it doesn't give astrology a very good name, I don't think.
So can you tell us about your role as an astrologer? Do you do people's charts mainly?
I do people's charts. I have had a full-time job in another area until recently, so I haven't given it as much time as I would like to, but that will change. But I am obviously, as I've said before, professionally qualified. And I did actually write a problems column, an astrological problems column, for one of our local newspapers. It wasn't something like, am I going to meet a tall, dark, handsome stranger? They were genuine problems that anybody might sort of face in their lives. I mean, one example I can think of was, there was a man who was a baker. His son was getting to an age when he might come into the family business. And the man wrote and said, I'm not sure about this. I'm not sure that, you know, he can settle down in a job like this. Can you have a look at both our charts and see what you think? And so, looking at them, I was just able to say to him that, first of all, he had to make quite sure, because he was an Aries, he had to make quite sure that he stayed the boss. But his son...
What star sign was his son?
Libra. Oh. Which actually meant that he enjoyed working with other people. I mean, his whole chart said that. I'm not just taking the sun signs. Yeah. I mean, I'm simplifying it now. And so I was just able to suggest the qualities that his son had. I wouldn't have said, oh, yes, you must definitely take him on. It'll be a brilliant partnership. But I was able to sort of pick out the things that he needed to do and perhaps the positive qualities that his son had that would make it all right for them to work together.
Do you think astrology can help people cope with redundancy?
Yes, I mean, I haven't looked into that incredibly, except in my own experience. It was very interesting because one of the planets is Uranus, one of the outer planets, Uranus, comes along, and if it hits certain sections of your chart, which is called a transit, when a planet comes along and hits points in your original birth chart, Uranus is there to really shake you up. And I wasn't expecting to be made redundant, but because I looked at my own chart, I knew that something was on the cards for me that was going to be quite sudden and could be shocking, but I probably needed it. But I kind of forgot that until the actual moment when I knew that I was going to be made redundant. And it doesn't take the shock away. It's up there with all the most shockable things that I've ever had in my life. And first of all, it suggested that I needed to be shaken out of a very comfortable, enjoyable rut, maybe, at work. I'd been there for 13 years and I really enjoyed what I was doing. But also, Uranus brings excitement. It brings lots of things into your life. And so I also had the feeling, I wonder what's around the corner. And in fact, my life has been absolutely frenetic ever since, you know, I knew about the redundancy. All sorts of things are happening. But I think partly because I've known that this is what Uranus is supposed to do, it's been helpful.
Do you think there's some positive message for people then who find themselves in that situation?
I wouldn't want to be so insensitive, though, as to say that it's the same for everybody. I mean, redundancy is such a shocking thing and it really depends on your circumstances. One of the things that I recognised, again, using myself, was that I knew I was feeling angry. I was terribly hurt, terribly angry. And I think what can happen with people that are made redundant, the anger goes inwards and then they get depressed, because I think depression is one of the things. And I think, you know, it's that sort of thing that an astrologer would want to be able to help somebody with. If you were dealing with somebody who came to you, you'd hope to, through talking through their chart with them, help them recognise that actually they needed to understand that they were angry and that it's fine to be angry, and that however, whatever way they can express it, I mean, they either go and get a rolling pin and hit a pillow, or they take up martial arts, or they just express their anger, they cry or they shout or whatever. So, you know, all that sort of thing, I think an astrological consultation can help.
That was Anthea Page talking to astrologer Judy Malone. Jeff Sparks is up north this week, but instead we have Trevor Carter in the studio to read us some of his poems.
OK, this has been inspired by a poet, one of the greatest poets of the 20th century, Louis MacNeice, who wrote an epic work called Autumn Journal in 1938, just before the Second World War. It was a time when there was an aura of threat and tremendous worry about what lay ahead. And this is just a little caption from Autumn Journal. The luxury life is only to be valued by those who are short of money or pressed for time. As the cinema gives the poor their Jacob's ladder for Cinderella's to climb. So the Autumn Journal was a fantastic work because it was a mixture of history and personal situation, so it's quite a unique epic poem. And inspired by that, I started to write my own Autumn Journal as everything started to fall apart financially and socially in last autumn. So this is the first installment of my Autumn Journal, inspired by Louis MacNeice. The bubble's gone pop, but have we burnt our bridges from a more rational organisation of economic life? Things can only go so far before they stop, then we fall over the ridges and whine about the inevitable strife. All bubbles must pop, all rivers must flow, all dynamics return to dust or fire. When things get too clever for their own good, it seems only fair that they should expire. Easy loans were no Jacob's ladder, just a one-way ticket to a paper moon, to dazzle Cinderellas who thought they had a chance to get to the ball before high noon. Why give free fuel to fakes and floozies? Aren't they sad enough without encouragement? The business of business should be a better business, Where can honest folk turn when the banks are bent? Incredible credit was a poison chalice, whether or not the malice had intent, and in any case would Cinderella look at home in a palace, should be more at ease paying council house rent. I'm writing this, my autumn journal, inspired by MacNeice's tomb of 1938. At that time also, we stood at a crossroads and feared the paths by which we were about to degenerate. But the present monster is a beast of our own making, grown fat on the bones of common sense, that we've thrown to the wolves of the banking system without giving any thought to contingency defence. In the midst of the mayhem, I'm feeling fine. We have no need for cheap money or cheaper thrills. We nibble our chocolate and drink our wine. We don't need false loans for happy pills. The ills of the world wash around, but not over us. We're, of course, concerned, but don't need to fuss. There is luxury of sorts in simple plenty. Our business is the business of being us.
Excellent. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for inviting me in. Can I just give a plug to the South Bank Cabaret, which is happening at the South Bank Centre, Dean Lane, on the 29th and 30th of this month. Tickets are available from the Grant Bradley Gallery. That's on Bedminster Parade. The last cabaret was a fantastic success, and we were vastly oversubscribed. It was a big sellout, so I do urge people to book ahead, because it's a fantastic night.
Brilliant. And interesting you chose Louis MacNeice as well. I know very little about him, but I was looking through the poetry section in Waterstones, and I happened to pick his book up and read a poem called Wolves, I think.
Right.
And I was very touched by it. I found it to be very easily written, but intensely well thought out at the same time. I shall dig that out, and we shall have a bit of Louis MacNeice poetry next week, I think. Thank you very much for coming in.
Okay, thank you.
That's all from Dialect Radio this week. In the studio were Kenneth McFarlane from MSA Foods in Bridgewater. His website, all about cheese, of course, is www.cheeseyogurtessentials.com. So much comic potential in the word cheese. I found that unexpectedly fascinating. And Guthrie Kennard, all the way from Austin in Texas. Don't forget, he's got a new album out. Look up that. Look up Guthrie Kennard on the internet. I'm sure you'll find him. And don't forget, you can hear great musicians like Guthrie every Sunday at the Coronation Tap in Clifton Village, where you can try a hair-raising half pint of exhibition cider. Excellent. Like all excellently talented people, Guthrie Kennard proved to be a very modest gentleman. What an excellent man he is. How should we say, lyrical accent. You can access more of Katie Brooks, who played on the show today, at www.myspace.com/Katie Brooks, spelling Katie, of course, K-A-T-E-Y. Malcolm Grieve, thank you to Malcolm, the actor who read Chapter 2 of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. And Trevor Carter finished us off, so to speak, he didn't finish us off, but he ended the show in the absence of Jeff Sparks with a poetry reading. And look up, of course, Louis MacNeice, excellent poet. Features were by Anthony Page, and the studio engineer was Phyllis Tritch-Curran, and also Alistair Grutz, who is first time on the hot seat today. Didn't he do well? The producer with Anthony Page, next week we'll have the Bolsheviks in the studio to entertain us, and Jeff Sparks will be back. Until next week, we'll be back at Queen Square next week. It's goodbye from all of us, and take care of yourselves.